Narnia is white and Calarmin, they're
darker. And then you have scimitars and turbans, but then you also have, you know, bright red beards.
You're listening to the podcast for those who have looked beyond the edge of the world.
And can't stop talking about it.
Welcome to Talking Beasts.
From NarniaWeb.com.
Where we explore the world of C.S. Lewis.
And keep a watchful eye.
On the latest Narnia movie news,
this
is Talking Beasts.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back. I'm your host, Rillian.
And I'm Glumpuddle. Did you see the Oscars, Rillian?
I did not see the Oscars.
Unfortunately, Shape of Water won, which I was really not thrilled with personally.
I was really hoping
expectation because it's Guillermo del Toro, but me and my wife were both really disappointed with it.
I was really personally hoping that Logan would walk away with something, but
superhero movie nominated for adapted screenplay. That's a first. And I was really happy Blade Runner got cinematography. That was Roger Deakins, the DP, his 14th nomination and first win.
Yeah, I want to see that. And I have to also give a huge slow clap to Mr. John Williams, who is nominated again for a musical score. That man is a machine.
Gosh, he's kind of the Meryl Streep of movie scores.
He is kind of the Meryl Streep
of movie
scores.
Why not?
You know what? Meryl Streep and John Williams are extremely talented.
Okay, fair enough.
I mean, it's extraordinary. But that's to a certain extent. Sometimes I get tired of the Oscars because it's somewhat predictable and political. It's like, well, we're going to acknowledge your talent, but we're not going to let you win them all. That's just not fair. That's why. Help me out. He did Django and Pulp Fiction.
Quentin Tarantino.
What does he say? He says he's only going to do, 9 movies in his whole life? 10? Something like that?
Yeah, I think he's just got one more.
He says he'll get, so that one will probably get an Oscar. He just has to make it, a serious or kind of important film. It can't be a comedy. Can't be a superhero film.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, so in all seriousness, guys, we had some great comments on the last podcast episode, and we want to thank you for those. And we want to highlight just a few of them. And three in particular. But this one spawned some discussion. It was from Colonel Clink. And
sorry for calling you Cole Clink. Colonel Clink.
Wait, did you call?
I said Cole Clink. Sorry.
Who?
I was thanking everybody that commented.
Do you not know what Colonel Clink is from?
Sorry, I don't.
Hogan's Alley?
Still don't know what that is.
Hogan's Heroes, sorry.
Oh, still
not Hogan's Alley. Hogan's Heroes is a TV show that took place in a concentration camp in the 1940s, but it's actually a comedy. And Colonel Clink was one of the main characters, actually played by someone who survived a concentration camp. But it's a really, really, I don't know, if you like 1940s humor, it's a fun show, and the show lasted longer than World War II did, but it's still a fun show.
I have learned something.
Anyway, Colonel Clink was a major character.
Here, right in the middle of a recording on Talking Beasts, I've actually learned something from our discussion. Who would have thought?
Not about Narnia.
Not about Narnia, but...
Okay. So Colonel Clink says, as an adult, I've really come to admire Huynh because of the scene where she stops Erebus from killing herself. Bree revealed his identity to Shasta because he could see that Shasta was from the north, and he assumed, perhaps naively, that anyone like that would want to help him. Huynh had no reason to think she wouldn't be turned into a freak show if she spoke to Erebus, but she did it anyway because she valued human life so much. Great to have the book analysis back. I just wish they came more quickly.
Working on it. Well, I guess it's interesting.
I think we had a volunteer for a new editor.
Colonel Clink.
Colonel Clink, email us at podcast@narniaweb.com.
Can be the assistant editor to AJ Aiken. I think just the first part of that is the about Huynh is the one that people were really responding to that I wanted to get into.
Well, we talked about it. She's kind of an underrated character.
Or
maybe undervalued.
Yeah.
Maybe that's a better way to put it.
I'm sure I'll get into it probably more in this discussion. I guess I can just bring it up now. But so, you brought that up the last episode about, you know, she's kind of a, who was it who said, I'm going to loan it to the Talking Beast Facebook group. And Marcus said that one of the reasons Huynh seems like she's always in the background is because she's the only one in the group that doesn't have a character arc, meaning, you know, she's pretty much the same at the end of the book as she was at the beginning. You kind of mentioned that thing about her in the past episode. I've thought about it the past couple weeks, and I think she's my favorite character in The Horse and His Boy now, kind of for that reason, that she just, Yeah, she's easily put down. Yes, she's kind of that stay with the ship R2 kind of character. but I don't know, almost like Captain America. I really appreciate what they've done with the Captain America character in the movies, and that's what it is he doesn't change.
Characters don't have to change to be great characters. They don't have to have a radical development or shift. I like that you can just uncover little nuances. I still think the most well-written character in the Harry Potter stories is Snape. And it's not because Snape changes radically in what he's doing or who he is from book 1 through 7. It's that you uncover more layers and you see more to the character.
Right. And I think, you know, with Hwen, it's somehow the fact that she goes through all this stuff and still is willing to, by the end of the book, go to Aslan and say, I'd rather be eaten by you than fed by anyone else. I think that's heroic. And obviously mm-hmm. the scene that Colonel Kling's talking about here with, where Hwen and they do a movie, The Horse and His Boy. They have to find a way to get this image into the movie, but it's the image of Hwen putting her head between the knife and Erebus's heart. That's such a powerful image. And Hwen is, like Colonel Klink's pointing out here, is sort of sacrificially exposing herself at great personal risk, whereas Bree is kind of using Shasta. So Hwen is certainly mm-hmm. for, like, she really risked everything to save Erebus, someone who she probably didn't even really know very well, or probably knew
of
her.
She's certainly the humbler and more noble of the two horses.
Which is one of the whole group. Yeah, that's one of the. Which is one of the themes of the story, obviously. But
we can get into more of this as we continue to discuss the chapter 3.
Okay.
And then also Narnia Fan 7.
Do you want to read that one? Narnia Fan 7 posted, I didn't think it was strange that there was no reference to Aslan when the lions show up when I first read the book. Honestly, I think it would have been strange if Aslan was mentioned, since most of the main characters either don't know who Aslan is or don't think he's a lion. The only exception is Hwen, and if I remember right, it's not clear what she thinks about Aslan. That's a really good point, actually.
It is kind of an alien story, too. I mean, you're in an alien world, really. Uh-huh. Everything's very non-Narnian, so it would be weird to... Because it would almost jar you back into, oh, wait, that's right, I guess this is Narnia. I guess Aslan is supposed to make an appearance here soon.
To me, it added to the sense of... even in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, when Edmund sees the statue of that lion, and almost immediately one of his first thoughts is, oh, probably this is the great lion Aslan. It just added to the sense of alienation to just have, a random lion, and just casually mention it, and there to be no kind of acknowledgement. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that was Lewis's intention or not, but I felt that just kind of added to the sense of it's almost like we've started a whole new series here. Just have a random lion character.
New trilogy. Sorry.
A horse. Oh, boy. Resist. The Horse and His Boy. A Narnia story.
Yeah. Anyway.
Then we've got Roger.
Who says, it is hard choosing which of our protagonists to choose from, but I have to go with... Oh, he might be responding to the poll. Because we have a survey.
That's right. We had a poll on the Talking Beast Facebook group. Let me scroll mm-hmm. down really quick and see where that is. And
well, there was NarniaWeb.com and the Facebook group.
That's right.
So while you're checking that, I will read from Roger. He says, it is hard choosing which of our protagonists to choose from, but I have to go with Erebus because she has the most to lose. The other three are going home, but Erebus might be going to poverty, but she keeps her virtue and honor. I'm not saying that she is not flawed. She is, but she is making the biggest change. She has no idea or dream that she will become queen. I have to say, Roger, I voted the same way. Erebus is probably my favorite character in the book.
Yeah, she has, I think, it could say the best. In fact, who was it that said in the... I just like giving shout-outs, sorry. Oh, it was Ellie in the Talking Beast Facebook group that said Erebus has the best character development. And that is a good point. If you look at where she starts and where she ends and what she's risking, and we'll probably get to more of this in later discussion. But, yeah, I do appreciate mm-hmm. the fact that of the four, she's the only one who... I mean, Shasta was born somewhere north, he suspects, and has kind of secretly longed for, subconsciously in some way longed for this his whole life. Both Hwen and Bree are trying to get home. Narnia is where they're from. And that leaves Erebus, who all she knows is what she's heard from Hwen. And yet she has that mm-hmm. same longing as well. Even she knows there's something, even though she grew up in this culture, she knows there's something wrong. And that brought to mind, I think it's the very first chapter of Mere Christianity, where C.S. Lewis talks about this idea of the law, what he calls the law of human nature, which is this idea that there are things, or asking the question, are there things that human beings just know, sort of, that are rules that we expect human beings to follow, regardless of where they were brought up, regardless of their background, that there is this, like, is there this universal law that we expect other people to follow. And the fact that I think that it's not exactly the best example, but the fact that Erebus was, this is her culture.
It's kind of a Romans she one was, argument to a certain extent.
Yeah, I mean, she was just brought up in this culture. She doesn't know any different, and yet she still knows this is wrong, and she would rather commit suicide than go along with the expectations of that culture. So I think that it with the other three characters, it makes sense why they would want to go to Narnia. Or why they would know my present situation. This isn't right. Something's wrong. But Erebus was born in this culture, and even she can sense that, no, there's something. There's got to be something better out there.
Yeah, that's actually a great segue into the opening of chapter 3. I mean, last time we left our heroes, they...
Last time on the horse and his boy.
Last time we left our heroes, they had just been reunited. Not reunited, united for the first time. But no, we just finished with... Shasta and Bree and Wynn and Erebus meeting, and we actually don't even know Erebus's name yet. But chapter 3 opens right up into Erebus's story.
My name is Erebus Takina.
Where she's apparently of royal lineage, going back to, in their mythology, going back to the god Tash as one of her ancestors, which to me evoked a lot of images of Greek mythology, where you have the gods descending down, and you had the children of the gods running around on Earth, and Erebus goes over her family and her impending marriage to Ahoshta,
mm-hmm.
and her escape from that, and a lot of the stuff here, the differences with Kalorman culture, it really is. Cultural aspects, and we talk about culture and differences in our modern day society. We talk about a lot of times very superficial things. We talk about clothing, we talk about food, we talk about dance and music and things like that, which they're mentioned here, but we get far more description of views on authority, respect, the religion, the way that family is supposed to operate, the way that men and women marry. The differences here, the contrast with Narnia, it's easy to kind of, because you're using your imagination, it's easy to kind of, boom, you just fill in a lot of images that aren't necessarily described a whole lot. But a lot of the differences, they really are differences in idea. And I think it was one time Ravi Zacharias said, every culture, the biggest differences in cultures is they're asking the question, what is the meaning and purpose of human life? And how do we live that out? And I'm paraphrasing there, but that is really the significance in the difference.
And Shasta doesn't know what it, Shasta doesn't know exactly what it is, but he looks north and says, oh, my father, what is there beyond that hill? He knows that this can't be it. There's got to be something else. And that's the book right there.
Mm-hmm. Well, and there's something that I didn't even really think about a whole lot until I was preparing for this podcast. And one of the themes that you see here is this idea of family and separation from family, not just, oh, family's nice. Like a Disney movie.
It's about family.
But sorry, dig. But no, it's, you have Erebus reevaluating who her real family is. Wynn is more her family than her own father is. You have Shasta longing for his family from whom he's separated. You have Bree and Wynn.
And Shasta, he feels like he ought to love his father. And he finds it hard to love his father, and that bothers him.
Yes. And there's this underlying theme that we see throughout the story that I don't think I really picked up on until I was thinking about it for this discussion.
Yeah, I agree. I hadn't made that connection until I saw your notes. Yeah, I think that ties in perfectly with the question of where do I really belong? When we think about family, we think of a place where I can be myself, where I can be comfortable and say, yes, I'm here. This is where I really belong. And none of the characters in the story feel like they are the place where they're supposed to be. So I think that ties in perfectly.
Now I'm finally where I belong, where I belong. Yeah, this is home. I've been searching for a place of my own. Now I've found it, maybe this is home.
characters, it's not just about, well, where can I be happy? Where can I belong? And I'm not saying that that's all you were saying it was, but it's how can I fulfill my purpose? You know, Bree is talking about, well, give me, don't talk about those wars. Because, you know, yeah, they were exciting, but I was just pretending to be a dumb beast. Give me the Narnian wars. Those were things worth fighting for. And you have, you know, I mean, Erebus isn't just thinking of, oh, I want to escape to this land of Narnia and be, you know, be, it'd be nice, be free. There's this kind of this longing for how do I actually fulfill what I'm supposed to fulfill and live to be who I'm supposed to be.
Uh-huh. That's a great example of Bree. You know, he's fought wars as a slave, but he longs to fight Narnian wars where he's fighting for something he really believes in and feels like this is my proper place.
Which he can't do when he's not home.
Exactly. Especially when he's just being a slave to people he doesn't respect, or certainly doesn't respect. You know, he mocks them, saying like, "I know he's not going to live forever," and he certainly he doesn't believe in any of this.
Yeah.
And I think I'll take another opportunity, slight sidetrack, to plug the Logos Theater's production of Horse and His Boy coming out next year, because. And director Nicole Stratton was doing an interview on the NarniaFans.com Facebook page. They were doing a live stream, and she mentioned the way they're going to handle Erebus's flashback backstory in the play is Erebus is going to actually walk around the stage and kind of narrate. Like there'll be actors, like, you know, enacting what she's talking about, and she'll walk in and out.
Oh,
of the
so
scene,
like another two actresses for Erebus, basically.
Oh, I don't think there'll be two actors for Erebus, but she'll essentially walk in and out of the scene. Maybe she'll even be addressing the audience. I don't know, but she'll be walking around the stage, and the scene she's describing will form around her, and she'll drift in and out of those scenes. Basically, she'll drift back and forth. I guess it sounded like to me like she'll drift back and forth between being the narrator and actually being in the scene, and that sounds like a really cool way to handle it. And I'm really excited to see it. So, the Logos Theater's stage adaptation of Horse and His Boy coming out. Well, won't be out till spring 2019, but I'm crazy excited about it. Just mentioning that. Anyway,
so they throughout the chapter they continue to get to know each other. Erebus and Bree discover that they know that some of the same people.
I love these dynamics. I love the
like,
fact.
Oh,
that,
you know, Bill. Yes, Bill. What
and
the
Shasta,
hair? Yeah.
Shasta feels left out, and I love when Shasta keeps interrupting. And Bree's just like, shut up. And I love it. Shasta.
Be cool, man. Be cool.
Yeah. Well, because Shasta is the most, he's the least in the know. Of these three characters. He doesn't really know what they're talking about. And he feels left out by that. So I love watching that dynamic kind of develop. And I love when he says, well, how could you be married? You know, like, I don't think you're any older. Or how could you be getting married? I don't think you're any older than I am. And Bree's just like, they're always married at that age in Kalorman. And, you know, Shasta feels really dumb. But
I'm so sorry.
I love the dynamic of, and especially certainly the two most powerful. I think it's Bree and Erebus are really the one of the four. They're the ones that really get along the most.
They're the strong, powerful, you know, D-type alpha personalities here.
I love all the overlapping character dynamics here Erebus and Huynh. You have the more traditional horse and rider kind of relationship where Erebus feels like the one in power. And then, of course, the relationship the title refers to, which is the fact that Bree really feels like the owner of Shasta and that power dynamic. And I love...
Which is a great title.
It's an awesome title.
It's a memorable title. It says a lot.
It's
the
best title of the seven because it's a really simple... How many fantasy stories probably have the title or the words boy and horse in them of some kind? And to do it that way, it's really, really simple, but it makes you kind of do a double take and go, wait, what does that mean exactly? And it's perfect. And the whole theme, one of the big themes of the book is humility. And so having that, the title reference that aspect of it is, anyway, I love that title.
When you have Huynh, who's the most humble character, who's the only one who actually comes up with the plan to get through Tashbaran.
That's a really good point. You know, like we talk about Huynh, I just thought of that. Huynh it being kind of a background character. You almost forget about her sometimes because in the book acknowledges that. It's intentional. She's always, she was, you know, easily put down. But one of her shining moments of the story is it is basically her idea of the entire plan of how we should go through Tashban. And she even, like I just posted in the Talking Beast Facebook group today, I realize she stands up to Bree. You know, Bree doesn't want to cut their tails, and he's really skeptical about it. And he's like, oh, we can't arrive in Narnia with cut tails, you know. And she's like, and I use this quote all the time in my personal life. But she goes, well, the main thing is to get there. And she just wants to get there.
Well, said Wynn humbly, she was a very sensible bear. The main thing is to get there.
Exactly. And I love the fact that she has that moment of actually standing up to Bree. That's definitely, it's easy to kind of forget about Wynn, but she obviously plays a really important role in the story. And we'll get to, by the end of the book, we'll get to her heroic moment. And by gosh, we were supposed to be into chapter 4 by now, weren't we?
We were. But anyway, so they continue some raiding, which is like, oh yes, that is stealing. But
yeah, I guess
but it's a story.
Okay. We'll go with it.
But we come to the gates of Tashman, which really are a great intro to the city. And it's interesting because I'm going to admit, I confess, whenever I read this part where they're moving through the streets of Tashman, I think about Hans Zimmer's score from Gladiator as they're going into Rome. And I kind of picture it being a lot like Rome. Oh. It was really messy and dirty. And
well, at least it's not like the Howard Shore score from the Return of the King of Minas Tirith. That's what I thought you were going to say, actually.
Oh, no. If anything, it would be Harry Gregson Williams from the Kingdom of Heaven, but no.
Gotcha. Well, never mind then. What do I know? But yeah, I mean, I like the fact that, you know, when they first arrive, Shasta's first impressions, of course, you know, he's a fisherman's son, so I guess maybe he's easily impressed. But his first impressions is, wow, this is a wonderful place. And then as they get in there, because it looks great from the outside, and then as you get in there, there's trash everywhere, and it's sweaty and crowded, and it smells bad. And I think that's such a great picture of what we've seen of Kalarman culture, which is they're so, with their wise little sayings, and they're so, you know, what's the word? You know, the pageantry, like we talked about before. But when you come right down to it, it's really hollow. It looks really different from the inside than it does on the outside. It's ultimately about building themselves up. It's not really about serving something greater. Narnia is all about serving something greater than themselves.
Yeah. Well, and that's the interesting thing is, you know, it's sometimes as you look at the differences between Kalorman and Narnia, it's easy to get focused on straight swords and scimitars. Uh-huh. Long swords and scimitars, and you just forget, you know, what is, you know, just the importance of money in Kalorman culture. A human being is worth a certain amount of money.
Sure.
You know, depending on how strong or how old the person is, that's what influences the money exchanged. Even they talk about carbuncles. They talk about jewels. You know, well, you know, a son is more precious than carbuncles. That has to be a saying, you know, because it's not
right.
So, but yeah, that's the interesting thing with colonial culture.
And this is probably, I mean, I know we're this discussion was supposed to be, we're kind of behind in our pacing here, but this is kind of the best place, I think, to ask the question about the betrayal, the way Lewis talks about colonial culture and accusations of racism. Especially in our post 9/11 world, it's, you know, it's easy to jump on that. And I even mentioned before we started recording to you, it's, oh, we should talk about that. Do you want to talk about that now? Or would you rather take some time to think it over? And you were like, no, I could talk about it, like how you want to word it. So
I can't think of too many, because if you're just thinking of, oh, Middle Eastern culture, you know, because it talks about darker, these people have darker skin, the Kalormans do. And but you think, okay, yes, there are scimitars.
Narnia is white and Kalorman, they're darker.
They're darker. Yeah. And then you have scimitars and turbans. But then you also have, you know, bright red beards. And I think to a certain extent, on one hand, obviously, it's supposed to evoke some of the Arabian Nights kind of imagery.
Right.
And to a certain extent, almost like... you know, like if you look at the movie Aladdin, it's kind of like, what is this? Is this Persia? Is this you know, Iraq? Is this India? What is this? Because it's kind of this weird mismatch. Which, of course, Narnia culturally is a weird mismatch of all these different cultures. I mean, you can't get different.
Well,
in terms
it feels
of,
very English, though. Obviously,
it feels very English to a certain extent. But then you have all this Norse stuff, and you have all this Greek stuff. So there's a mismatch there. This is kind of a mismatch too. But at the same time, I think sometimes our imaginations fill it in. And to another extent, though, again, what are the critiques here? If in terms of, well, it's a bad portrayal. Well, bad portrayal of what? Certainly not all the characters are bad characters. Erebus is, again, my favorite character.
And she is a mix. She does noble things and she does bad things.
Yeah, there's noble things, bad things. Bree does noble things and cowardly things.
Uh-huh.
You know, Shasta does noble things and ignorant things.
Right.
There is the real key here is in terms of, okay, well, is it racist? There's no tie or relationship between the ethnicity of someone in the story and then the idea.
It's not as simple as, the white Narnians are good and all the dark Kolarmans are bad. It's certainly not that simple.
It's not, because you have, you know, Erebus for one thing. There's no reason or any kind of link that's supposed to be established. Like, well, because of this, that's why they believe these. No, it's just this group of people has this sets of values. This other group of people has different sets of values. And it's the values that are critiqued.
Mm-hmm.
And everything else is purely superficial. There's nothing better in the story about the turbans or non-turbans. There's nothing better in the story about, like, well, the straight swords are better than the scimitars. None of that. Again, it's all the superficial stuff. And we get very fixated on superficial creations of culture in our society. Because we think about music and food. And, like, at some point, that doesn't matter. The only thing to really critique is the actual idea behind what is the meaning of life? How do you live your life? What are the answers to life's deep questions? And that is where Kolarm and culture is left wanting.
Wow. Okay. I really don't have much to add to that. I mean, I will say that I
wasn't trying to just steal the air, but
no. I mean, I agree with all that. I will say, I think if Lewis had written the story in a post 9/11 world, I think he would have written it differently. I think he would have been.
Oh, sure.
I think he would have been a little more sensitive. So I think it's perfectly understandable how in today's world how you would read it that way. So people who are uncomfortable with it, who are just reading it now for the first time, I completely get that, and that makes sense.
Yeah.
I think it's worth pointing out that Kolarmon is clearly not monotheistic, and so it's not just. And people will say, I didn't think I'd go this far in the podcast, but and people will say, the Kolarmons are just Muslims, and they're clearly not.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, a lot of aspects of the culture are very different, just in terms of how the women are described, in terms of the lifestyles and everything, and also, you know, we're in a kind of a reductionist culture where, and when I say reductionist culture, obviously my experience is primarily the United States, although I've spent some brief stints in the UK, but a lot of the discussion, it's kind of white and black, and it's very, very simple in terms of, you know, C.S. Lewis's background. You know, he lived through two world wars where, with, you know, white supremacists and Aryan mentalities, basically the driving force of evil, you know, that, so that was his perspective on, you know, the potential for evil in the world. It wasn't really the same kind of, like, the post 9/11 perspective that a lot of us have.
Right.
And so it's important to understand the variations there too. And a lot of times, I mean, good grief, if you look at the wars of Rome, I mean, you have all these barbarians and Romans and all these different groups of people who probably looked kind of similar, you know, just like, cause the identity was, you know, different. So it's, and Lewis was very familiar with those types of histories. That's why I say, well, okay, it's not like Narnia is just English, because again, you look at the mythology cluster there, you're pulling from all over the place.
Right. And, I mean, obviously, people read it and they have the experience they have with it, and it is what it is. But if we're talking about Lewis's intentions, I think it's pretty clear that, you know, Narnia, yes, it's a mishmash in many ways, but it's also very English. And so that's where he starts. And so when he goes to Horse and His Boy and he wants to make it feel as different as possible, it's not surprising that's kind of the direction he would take a completely different culture he wants to add to his world. So, I mean, I think that the more you break down what Lewis's intentions probably were, I don't think you can accuse him of being racist. That said, if you're going to make a movie out of this in the next several years, I mean, do you think this is something they can just completely, well, let's just totally reimagine Kolarman culture to not kind of have those associations and still preserve the essence of it?
Yeah, I think there's a couple different pathways there. You can, I mean, on one hand, it's kind of weird how Hollywood does things. I've kind of wondered how Disney's going to handle the new Aladdin movie, which to a certain extent is, you have everyone in the same group. So it's, hey, there's no, you could say there's no issues. But then there's always like the Prince of Persia movie where you have a white guy, you know, cast right. as the main character. Uh-huh. So, yeah, I think one thing they might do is they might do some really extreme, and I might be fine with this, kind of just, hey, let's completely reimagine Kalorman culture, make it look completely new, you know?
Yeah, I'd be open to that.
I'd be open to that too if it were done well. And I mean, again, when he's talking about the red beards and things, we kind of just fill in our imaginations with things we're familiar with. But I think that Lewis would actually be okay with a lot of different ideas too, in terms of like the architecture. It doesn't have to all look like the onion domes like you see in the in the Aladdin movies,
right? And in my mind, you know, the book was written in 1954, and the movie is going to be made in the year 2000 something, if it gets made. It's perfectly valid to say, well, Lewis is writing for himself at a certain point in history, or writing for an audience at a certain point in history. While we're making this movie, we're obviously not making this for the same audience. I think it's perfectly valid to try to reinterpret. Yeah, because once again, I think if Lewis had been writing the book today, he would have written some things a little differently.
And it may just be that, you know, certain groups just are not going to be pleased. You know, The Lord of the Rings, I don't think, could be really made today. Uh-huh. And it faced enough criticism in its time, even though I don't think Tolkien was a racist. So,
yeah, I'm trying to think, is there anything in the book where it's, oh, well, that has to be, like it has to have that association somehow? Like, if you drastically change the Kalorman culture, does it really, if you fundamentally change the way the Kalorman culture feels, that it would change something essential about the story or character? Off the top of my head, I can't think of anything. If you can think of something, post a comment
again
below.
The way you're phrasing it, change something about the Kalorman culture, the way that you're thinking of it, you're thinking about the aesthetics.
Basically, yeah.
No,
like, do those aesthetics.
I wouldn't want the movie to change the Kalorman culture in terms of how materialistic it is and how
dehumanizing
it is.
Yeah, I'm just talking about the aesthetics. Is there any scene or character moment where it's those aesthetics are really essential and you can't avoid
really,
it? I can't think of anything.
I think Lewis understood that that's not really that important.
It was just that as long as the Kalorman culture feels really different from Narnia and really gives you a sense of alienation from what you've seen before, that's the most important thing.
I mean, think about it. You could completely flip it and have essentially the same story.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking is the case. But listeners, if you can think of any examples of, ooh, how are they going to handle this scene or character, post a comment below or in the Talking Beast Facebook group.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the things that Lewis does in the story to kind of give you this new perspective, I mean, the whole book is, here's another introduction to Narnia. And we talked about that in the last episode, how we've had Jill Pohl's perspective on Narnia. Introduction to Narnia. We've had Lucy's. We've had Eustace's too. Mm-hmm. And we're with Shasta, and we get not just a reintroduction to Narnia, but we'd get a new introduction to characters that we know and love.
So should we, which the Pevensies, of course, should we? I mean, we're north of 30 minutes here. Should we save that for the next episode, you think?
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I think.
It really does make sense since we end with basically.
Is anyone still listening? Are you there? Are you there? Are you still with us? Are you snoring? Yeah, okay. I guess we should wait till the next episode.
Sam's there. Sam is faithful.
What about Henry?
With us.
How's Henry doing?
He's crying.
He wants us to end. Okay.
He wants us to end.
We'll give Henry the deciding vote.
And the next thing for us to do is the Stump of Narnia Weber, and I will be stumped or not. But before we do that, we have Voices of Narnia Web and the C.S. Lewis Minute. We'll be right back.
Voices of Narnia Web.
Hello, Talking Beasts. This is NarniaFan7 from Ohio. I don't actually remember the first time I ever heard about the Chronicles of Narnia. Growing up, I pretty much always knew what they were. I had three older siblings who all read the books, and I remember seeing bits and pieces of the BBC series on TV. And I vividly remember one time when I was about five, my oldest sister read me the first chapter of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe one night before bed. But for whatever reason, I never really took any interest in Narnia at all until I was nine and saw Disney and Walden's The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe in theaters. I remember it completely blew me away, and it kind of made me fall in love with the whole idea of Narnia, this magical world where animals can talk and where all these mythical, fantastic creatures are real. And so over the next few months, I read the entire series more for myself and absolutely loved it. These books are very important to me. They're my favorite works of fiction ever. I love the stories, I love the characters, I love Lewis's writing style, and a lot of the themes explored in the books, like the longing for one's true home, really resonate with me on a personal level. My favorite book is The Voyage of the Dawn Treader. I just love the idea of this small crew sailing off into the great unknown, not knowing what they're going to find. And I love the episodic nature of this story, how each island is kind of its own mini-story inside this larger story. Picking a favorite character is really hard. There are so many great characters throughout the series, but if I had to pick just one, it would be Shasta, or Kor, I should say. He's probably the character whose journey I relate to the most and the character who I see the most of myself in.
If you want to share what the Chronicles of Narnia means to you, send your voice to the email address in the episode description.
This is your C.S. Lewis Minute. I'm William O'Flaherty from EssentialCSLewis.com. Last time I told you about the first of a series of three science fiction books from Lewis. Today, learn about Perlandra, the second title. Owen Ransom is the central character again. He's been contacted to travel to the planet we know as Venus to help combat the evil influence of Edward Weston, who was one of the kidnappers that took Ransom to Mars in the first story. Perlandra, or what we call Venus, is a beautiful world full of floating islands that has been invaded by Weston as a tool from Satan to tempt the Eve of this world. Thus, we learn that Venus is an unfallen world. The queen of it, the Green Lady, might give in to temptation unless Ransom can intervene. Is it an impossible mission? Find out by reading Perlandra. Learn more about the creator of Narnia at my website, EssentialCSLewis.com. Again, I'm William O'Flaherty.
And we're back. And
your turn to get stumped this time.
You can try.
Let's stump a Narnia Webber, if we dare. Rillian, are you ready for this one? All right. Your question. In The Last Battle, Tyrion, Jewel, and Runewit the Centaur encounter a dryad, and they knew at once what kind of tree she belonged to. What kind was it?
Oh.
And I'll let you think for a second. If you want, you can ask
Willow
for
tree.
You can ask for multiple choice if you would like.
Oh, okay.
So just... Talk,
you know what? I didn't even have time to think about this throughout the episode like you did last time, so I'm just going to go.
Well, whose fault is that, moderator?
Well, you know what? It's hard working on this outline, okay? It's a lot of work.
So we'll just talk through the scene. Talk through what's going on. See if it comes to you.
I said Willow Tree.
Oh, you did? Sorry, I didn't hear you.
I did say Willow Tree. Yes, I said it multiple times.
Okay.
I'm just going to have to go with it because nothing else is going to come to me.
Willow Tree. Is that your final answer?
It is my final answer.
I'm afraid that is incorrect. It's actually a beech tree.
I wouldn't have gotten that.
That's from chapter 2 of The Last Battle after the dryad.
What were the options? Talking. Was Willow Tree an option?
It was one of the options. I'll give you that.
I would have gone with Willow Tree. There was no hope for me.
The
then.
Four options were beech, birch, tree. Oak, and willow. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
Well, I really did think Willow Tree.
All right, we'll continue horse and his boy discussion next week, but let's go to the outro. I added credits to the outro this time.
You've been listening to Talking Beasts, a NarniaWeb.com podcast. Be sure to subscribe and post a comment below or in the Talking Beasts Facebook group. You can also email us at podcast@NarniaWeb.com, Rillian@NarniaWeb.com, or glumpuddle@narniaweb.com. Special thanks to... Oh, good grief.
I have a type...
Aitken.
I'll try to change it.
AJ,
sorry. AJ Aitken. I added...
AJ Aitken. Okay.
Aitken. All right, sorry. I corrected that typo. Okay, but you knew what I meant.
Special thanks to AJ Aiken, Ryidian, and the Rose Tree Dryad. Look for new episodes every other Tuesday. Until next time, further up and further in.